This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome back to The Bunker, your daily bite-sized ration of news and politics. I'm Andrew Harrison. Back in the 80s, I can remember hearing about a parent who was at the end of their tether shouting at an angry toddler, "If you don't calm down, Margaret Thatcher will get you." Conservative Prime Minister from 1979 to 1990, during which time she presided over the Falklands War, the miners' strike and a programme of privatisation and deregulation which changed Britain out of all recognition, the greengrocer's daughter from Grantham remains Britain's most divisive figure. Hated on the left, worshipped on the right, she still casts a shadow over our politics 33 years after she left office. So when Keir Starmer invoked her name at the end of last year, saying that Thatcher had enacted meaningful change in the UK, the reaction on his party's left was predictably volcanic. And more recently, David Lammy described Thatcher as a visionary leader. Rachel Reeves, while not mentioning Thatcher by name, said Labour faced similar problems to those at the end of the 1970s, and that generated yet more rage. Why are Labour making these allusions and connections to Thatcherism now? What does it mean? And is it just symbolic or something real? To talk it all over, I'm joined by Dr. Robert Saunders, reader in British history at Queen Mary University and co-editor of the book Making Thatcher's Britain. Hello, Robert. How are you doing?
Hello. Very good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So, I mean, for any Labour leader, invoking Margaret Thatcher is kind of touching the third rail. She's still toxic to huge swathes of the party. As a political figure, she looms even larger the more she fades into the past. What is Starmer trying to do by bringing Margaret Thatcher into the conversation?
I think in some ways he's doing something actually quite conventional. If we were having this conversation in 1978, we would be talking about why was the leader of the opposition, Margaret Thatcher, making speeches praising Clement Attlee. Some people might remember in 2010, Ed Miliband's making speeches about Benjamin Disraeli and One Nation conservatism. David Cameron occasionally used to praise Tony Blair. On one level, this is just something that political leaders do. They pick a giant from their opposing party's past, and they use that to try to persuade voters that it's safe to jump ship, to say that actually we are a better vehicle for your aspirations than the kind of pygmies and minnows who are now running the Tory or the Labour Party. So on one level, he's just following in that tradition. But I do think there's actually something more substantial going on here as well. If we look at something like Rachel Reeves's Mays lecture, which she gave earlier this year, which is probably the party's most substantial attempt to set out its economic policies. She keeps making a contrast with the 1970s. Mm. She talks about the 70s as a decade when an old consensus was breaking down, when old policy tools were stopping working, when the economy, the social order, international relations all seemed to be breaking down. And out of that moment comes a leader, Margaret Thatcher, who has a clear sense of mission, and spends the next 10 years building something new. And I think what Reeves is trying to say there is not that we need a Thatcher outcome, but that this is a Thatcher moment. And she's trying to set Labour up in that kind of tradition.
That very much kind of fits with what the actual text of the praise that Starmer gave her at the end of last year. It was very qualified. It wasn't just a straightforward, "I love Margaret Thatcher." He wrote in the Sunday Telegraph that she was one of the few modern leaders to enact meaningful change in modern British politics. And he later qualified it and said, you know, she did do terrible things. And yet, I think the Mirror said it around the same time that he was playing with fire by praising Thatcher. Is it just that Thatcher isn't like those other giants of the past? She is far more divisive.
I think it's worth remembering that this all began with, I think, literally one sentence in an article that Starmer wrote in the Telegraph that he was then asked about on the Sunday morning radio programme. That same weekend, he gave a quite meaty speech to the Resolution Foundation about things like industrial policy, productivity, investment, which drew almost no media attention at all. So I think this is partly about actually the triviality of a lot of our public debate. It is just much easier to make a headline that says, "Fury as Starmer praises Thatcher," than it is to dig into Labour policy and ask what they're going to do in government.
Yeah. Do you think there might also be, I mean, you've already mentioned the kind of tactic of sort of strategically basing your opposition by belittling them in comparison to the giants of their own past. There's also an element of saying Labour is the true patriotic party. But is there also an element of saying to the Labour left, you're no longer in charge? You managed to annoy all the right people at the same time.
Yes, there is. And I don't think that Starmer would be at all disappointed with media reports in which members of Momentum attack him, because that reinforces the message that he's trying to send, that this isn't the party of Jeremy Corbyn. So I do think that's important. But I also think it's worth remembering that Margaret Thatcher herself borrowed ideas from the left. If we look at the people around Margaret Thatcher, you've got Alfred Sherman, one of her chief speechwriters, a former communist who had fought in the Spanish Civil War. You've got Hugh Thomas, who she put in charge of the Centre for Policy Studies, who had been a former Labour candidate and a Labour intellectual. There's a whole volume of essays published in 1978 called Right Turn, which is by people who started out on the left and have now switched to the Conservative Party. So ideas do move forwards and backwards between the two parties. And to some extent, when Starmer says, we are the party of patriotism, or we are the party of security, he's engaged in a kind of tug of war that's been going on between the two parties for as long as they've existed.
Mm. There is a constant refrain from the Labour left and the remaining sort of supporters of Corbyn that Starmer is a red Tory and he's indistinguishable from a Conservative. The policy platform things you mentioned, including tough fiscal rules, strong national defence, taking back our streets, even secure borders. These are taken from the current Labour Party website. Do you think there's any truth in that red Tory accusation?
I think there is a danger there of romanticising Labour's own record. I mean, let's take some of those lines. Strong national defence. It's the Attlee government that builds the nuclear bomb. It's the Attlee government that joins NATO. Taking back our streets. Labour Home Secretaries are notoriously tough on crime. Roy Jenkins is actually a really interesting exception in that he's one of the very few liberal Home Secretaries from the Labour Party. Even something like secure borders. The Labour Party in 1968 passed a Commonwealth Immigration Act, rushed it through Parliament in 3 days, partly to stop Kenyan Asians with British passports coming in. So whatever we think of those policies, they're not just concessions to Toryism. They have a history in the Labour Party itself, and one that goes back a long way before Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain key articles of the Thatcherite faith that are absolutely clearly absent. Tax cuts aren't in there. Privatisation isn't in there. Not that there's much left to privatise, but there is talk of, you know, renationalising rail, Great British Railways and so on. What do you think that if we were able to, you know, somehow divine this, she would make of Starmerism stroke Reevesism?
Well, of course, Thatcher and Reeves are operating in very different worlds and the challenges are quite different, but I think Margaret Thatcher would be quite alarmed at a lot of what she saw in a prospective Starmer-Reeves manifesto. There's quite a strong emphasis here on an active interventionist state that sees things like industrial policy, state-led investment, workers' rights, planning as being a key part of what governments do. I'm often struck, actually, when listening to the Today programme, by the way that politicians from both main parties keep saying, we have a plan. There's a real language of planning in British politics at the moment. And Margaret Thatcher didn't believe in planning. She believed that the government set the sort of broad macro rules, but actually that you let the free market kind of work its own magic, that planning wasn't something that governments should be particularly doing.
What are the key things that people remember in the relationship, the kind of, as you described, the tug of war between Labour and Thatcherism, is that Thatcher famously said that Tony Blair was their greatest achievement. We forced our opponents to change their minds. And, you know, obviously in the long aftermath of Blairism, the Labour left also charged Blair with effectively being a Tory in disguise. Blair didn't adopt Thatcherism, but he didn't try to reverse that much of it. Is there any truth in those accusations that he accommodated with what she had wrought?
Well, firstly, it's not totally clear that Margaret Thatcher did ever say that. The evidence for that is actually quite slight. She might have done, but if she did, it's very much at odds with most of the other things that she said about New Labour. She called it a boneless wonder that would put at risk the Renaissance of Britain. She called it a government which discredits and dishonours Britain. which in its shriveled heart is embarrassed by our history, scornful of our achievement, and oblivious of our legacy. So in some ways, the fact that everyone knows that quote about forcing Labour to change its minds illustrates the point that Margaret Thatcher is used to fight contemporary political battles. That quote is famous because it allows the left to say that Tony Blair is not authentically Labour.
Yeah. There's also a rich Labour tradition of leaders using her as a kind of self-sanitising move. I think Blair said, "I always thought my job was to build on some of the things she had done rather than reverse them. Whenever I wanted to ask her for advice, she would always give it in a genuine, spirited way," which sounds actually terrifying. I would not want to get Margaret Thatcher's advice in a genuine, spirited way. And I think Brown had her around for tea in Number 10 right after he acceded to power in 2007 and said that "I am a conviction politician like her." So, as you say, she's used as a tool, almost as a kind of, you know, touching the hem of the garment to get some of the magic.
Yes. And I think there is a perfectly serious policy debate to be had about what New Labour took from Thatcher and what it rejected. It's very clear that New Labour believed in running a dynamic market economy. It was very relaxed about inequality. It was quite keen to see things like competition and private finance extended across the public realm. And those are really substantial changes that Labour made during the Thatcher era. But on the other hand, we could come up with a litany of things that New Labour did that Margaret Thatcher would have found appalling. This is a government that spent colossal sums on public services, that doubled the NHS budget, that poured money into things like education. It created devolved parliaments around the United Kingdom, which was something to which Margaret Thatcher was strongly opposed. It believed quite strongly in things like gay rights. The Thatcher government's famously passed Section 28, which forbade, and I quote, "the promotion of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship." It introduced things like the national minimum wage, which is a very un-Thatcherite intervention in the market relationship between employers and employees. And if we look at the way that the right of the Conservative Party today talks about Tony Blair, and the way they talk about a kind of Blairo-Marxist consensus in British politics, they clearly think that some quite substantial things change in the 1990s. I think we should take that seriously.
Yeah, and I always find it, the image of the Blair government in that you see in the Mail and the Telegraph is so wildly more extreme and kind of red in tooth and claw than what I actually remember living under, that it's almost as if they're up against a mirage of their own making. They kind of want it to be much more extreme than it was.
Political projects always like to have a dragon to slay. Hmm. And in a sense, Margaret Thatcher was very useful to Labour in the 1980s because she stood so fundamentally for so many things that they disbelieved in. And there was a kind of impatience, I think, among many politicians with the more consensual politics of the 90s and beyond, because it wasn't as exciting. So if you can erect Blairism into some kind of monster, then you have a crusade, you have a cause that is worth fighting and dying for.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I want to ask you about the Conservative Party's own fixation on Margaret Thatcher. Do you think there's a form of Thatcher derangement syndrome in the party now where politicians have to demonstrate such extreme loyalty and fealty to her that even an actual practicing Thatcherite like Sunak is somehow not Thatcherite enough and is somehow kind of in their minds weak and leftist?
Yes, I think if we look back at that leadership contest in 2022, in some ways it was a battle between two different visions of Thatcherism. So Liz Truss literally dressed up as Margaret Thatcher and spent years curating a kind of album of pictures of her in Thatcherite poses. Rishi Sunak, I think, launched his campaign in Grantham. He went on a kind of pilgrimage to the birth site of Thatcherism to stress his own Thatcher credentials. But what they were offering really were two different memories of the Iron Lady. So for Rishi Sunak, it was about the careful household manager, somebody who balanced the books, who subordinated everything to the fight against inflation, who put up taxes in a recession in order to do that. Liz Truss, on the other hand, was presenting a kind of Gloriana image of Thatcher as someone who handbagged her opponents, who never compromised, who won the Cold War, and was this sort of charging bull political figure. So, you know, in some ways, it was a little bit like two branches of the same religion, both convinced that they represented the one true church and the other side were heretics. And I guess, you know, what that tells us is partly that the Conservative Party has been so factionalized in recent years, they actually have to go back quite some way to find a figure that they can all agree on. But also that Margaret Thatcher has become a myth. She's become a kind of legendary figure. And the nature of myths and legends is that each generation can tell them differently in a way that imprints different meanings on them.
I sort of wish Truss had lasted a little bit longer so we could start calling her the ironic lady, because everything that she followed failed. When you were editing the book, Making Thatcher's Britain with Ben Jackson, were there specific myths or misconceptions about Thatcher and Thatcherism that you thought needed dispelling?
We published that book in 2012, I think. And at that point, it actually felt like Margaret Thatcher was receding from contemporary politics. A lot of Cameron's early rhetoric was about a kind of post-Thatcherite conservatism. We were both teaching students who had been born after the Thatcher era. So what we wanted to do really was to do what historians do and to think about where the ideas of Thatcherism came from. What actually changed during her time in power? What did Thatcherism mean for Northern Ireland or for immigration or for economic policy? How might we situate it in the context of its times and things like the Cold War or the end of empire? So it's been quite odd, actually, to see Margaret Thatcher re-emerging more recently as a sort of figure of contemporary political warfare, and to see sort of old myths being reanimated about her as somebody who never compromised, someone who ran her government single-handed, who, depending on taste, was either the founder of the single market or the kind of prophet of Brexit. So it may be that we actually need to do a second volume now that kind of reconsiders the memory of Thatcher.
I suppose, ironically as well, Osborne and Cameron presented themselves as this kind of soft and modernised version of the Tory party, but actually much more vociferous Thatcherites in practice than even she was. I mean, the scale of the cuts that they enacted, this has been a theme that's been on a lot of our podcasts lately, ironically. You know, we all used to complain about cuts, cuts, cuts in the 80s, but actually what happened at the start of the 2000s were much deeper and much more lasting.
Yes, I think there's always a distinction in politics between tone and policy contents. Mm. And the Cameron governments were radically different in tone to the Thatcher era. You know, Thatcher was someone who relished political conflict. And that's partly why she was such a polarizing figure, that whenever you found a punch-up going on, she would put herself at its center. Whereas Cameron, rhetorically, was a much more unifying figure, someone who I think was quite comfortable working in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. But as you say, in policy substance, in many ways, this went much further. And I think that actually goes back to the point about the way that Thatcherism is remembered, because the memory of Thatcher has become someone who never compromised, who never backed down. And therefore, the Thatcherite thing to do is always the most radical, the most extreme policy. In practice, actually, despite the pugilistic rhetoric, Margaret Thatcher was in many ways quite a cautious figure in office, which is why there were still so many things yet to privatise, so many areas of public spending yet to cut after she left it.
Mm. I mean, I suppose one of the measures of a truly dominant phase of politics is that it creates a new reality that people can't imagine things being any other way. You know, Thatcherism left us with some things that just seem permanent now. Top tax rates never went back up to 83%. Union rules are never loosened and nobody's really talking about loosening them. Apart from rail, nobody really wants to re-nationalise telecoms or that degree of re-regulation. Do you think that there are things that Thatcherism left us that, you know, will never really change now?
I don't think we're going back anytime soon to the very high top rates of tax in the 1970s or to the huge nationalised industries of that period. But that's not just because of Margaret Thatcher. It's also because of things like changes in technology or the kind of economy that we have. You can't nationalise the iPhone or WhatsApp. You could nationalise the car industry. But that's very difficult when any individual car is going to have a chassis that's made in one country and an engine that's made in another and a software system that's been programmed somewhere else. Britain doesn't any longer have the kind of big primary industries that dominated the public sector in the 1970s. You could put tax rates back up to 83%, but that's going to raise a lot less revenue in an age when you can just press a button and move billions of pounds across the world. So these changes aren't just about Thatcherism. They're partly about a world that has changed dramatically. And to some extent, Thatcherism itself was a product of those changes.
Mm. She also drove the creation of the single market and kind of misty-eyed Remainers like me. I still remember that picture of her in the famous jumper when she was campaigning for Europe until the very end of a kind of late period when she kind of started to lose her grip. She was kind of grudgingly pro-Europe. Do you think that Margaret Thatcher was, by today's conservative standards, even really a Thatcherite?
I think that's a very good question. I think to some extent, when people today talk about Thatcherism, certainly when someone like Liz Truss talks about Thatcherism, she's talking about something that emerged in the 1990s rather than in the 1980s. So when Margaret Thatcher was no longer constrained by the realities of government, when she was spending a lot more time in the United States and with Republican politicians, and when she was quite embittered about her fall. So in the 1980s, she was actually quite cautious. In all sorts of ways, she picked her battles. She had quite good antennae for how fast she could go at any particular point in time. But in the 90s, she becomes this uncompromising crusader who never backs down. Or in the 1980s, she makes genuinely important speeches on things like global warming and the ozone layer. And yet by the 1990s, she's talking about environmentalism as some kind of Marxist conspiracy. As you say, in the 80s, she's mainly a pro-European politician at a time when actually Labour was much more Eurosceptic. But in the 90s, she starts to be seen as the kind of champion of a burgeoning Eurosceptic movement. So we get a different kind of Thatcherism in the 90s that mythologizes her time in power. And that's partly why it's difficult to apply in government, because it's not really about what Mrs. Thatcher did in office. It's about the legends that were spun around her after she left it.
So really, what she generates isn't so much a programme for government as a space where you can be Nigel Farage, or you can be the ERG, or you can even be Momentum, perhaps, where you can have all of the power and you can have the loud hailer without any of the inconvenience and tedium of having to actually govern and carry the can for what you do.
Yes, I mean, in some ways, she has passed into the world of mythology, as I suggested earlier. Bizarre comparison, but take someone like Robin Hood. We're all familiar with Robin Hood. Mm-hmm. But there are different versions of the Robin Hood myth. So, for example, there's a radical version of Robin Hood in which this is an outlaw who steals from the rich and gives to the poor, who resists authority. He's a common man who stands up for the common people. But there's another version of Robin Hood in which he's an aristocrat. He is the Earl of Locksley. He is the loyal subject of King Richard the Lionheart, and he's driven from his estate by the usurper King John and the Sheriff of Nottingham, but he still protects his people until he's restored to his estates. So that Robin Hood is a story about benevolent aristocracy. So myths and legends are always being retold and re-narrated in ways that suit present purposes. And Margaret Thatcher has entered that kind of realm, that you can tell different versions of Thatcherism that work for Liz Truss or Rishi Sunak, or even, as you say, potentially for Momentum.
It makes you give me the chilling thought of what the version will be in, say, 100 years' time, where we're all gone and there's nothing left to go on except secondary sources like the front page of the Daily Telegraph. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, finally, that she serves this purpose both as a purity test for the right and a kind of, you know, a litmus test for evil on the left. Do you think that's only going to expand as the reality of her kind of retreats into the past?
I think it's partly about the moment we're in at the moment, that Margaret Thatcher is both recent enough to be vivid and distant enough to be mythologized. So for people who remember the 1980s, the memories of this period are often still very raw. There is something about Margaret Thatcher, and it's partly just the voice and the manner and the way that she speaks that really seems to grip people's brains. I think there was a study a few years ago that found that dementia patients who didn't perhaps recognise their own family members, did recognise Margaret Thatcher. There was something about her that was extraordinarily memorable. And for those in the generation that followed, and that's most politicians now and most political journalists, she's the kind of giant under whose shadow they grew up. But I wonder whether that will change. So I teach a third-year special subject at Queen Mary on the 1980s. And what I find is that students are still very interested in Margaret Thatcher and very interested in that period, but they have very few preconceptions. They don't remember her death, let alone her life. She is to them what Harold Macmillan was to me growing up, someone I'd vaguely heard of, but I didn't have any particular views about. And I think when that generation is making the news, it's going to have different reference points. So it might be that we have to do this again in 20 years' time and talk about, you know, how the memory of Liz Truss or the memory of Ed Miliband has shaped British political history.
That's amazing. Fascinating stuff. Margaret Thatcher, it was acceptable in the 80s. Robert, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Really, really interesting. And listeners, thanks for listening. We do live in the merciless market economy that Margaret Thatcher bequeathed us, and podcasts are not immune from it. As you may know, advertising in the podcast world is undergoing one of its periodic downturns, so we're having to ask you, our loyal listeners, to chip in to keep us fit for purpose in this busy election year. Just £3 a month, if you sponsor us via Patreon, gets you the podcasts early and ad-free. A little more gets you our splendid mugs and t-shirts too. But most importantly, you'll be helping us to pay producers and presenters, and you'll be keeping the Bunker in rude health. Search Bunker Podcast Patreon, or just follow the link in the show notes to find out a little bit more. Thanks for listening. The pod is not for turning.
Hello, I'm Dorian Linsky.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Group Editor Andrew Harrison. The audio producer was me, Jade Bailey, and the managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.